You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Brookings and Charles Koch Institute event. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And we are going to be talking today about the so-called forever wars in the broader Middle East region and what a Biden presidency, along with the 117th Congress, should do about them. I'm joined by a distinguished group of scholars and friends from numerous institutions all around Washington, but nonetheless reflecting a real divergence and breadth of thinking, experience, and approach in thinking about these kinds of conflicts, with a lot of broad strategic expertise, and also a lot of field research and hands-on expertise. Chris Preble is at the New American Engagement Initiative at the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. He is a longstanding scholar. Many of you will know him from his years at the Cato Institute. His most recent book is Peace, War, and Liberty. He is also a former Navy officer and is in many ways one of the great skeptics and contrarian voices in American foreign policy and grand strategy thinking today, who I've known for a long time and really pleased to have him with us in this event. Justin Logan at Catholic University is at their Center for the Study of Statesmanship, used to be at Cato as well, and has recently written an important article in Defense Priorities called The Case for Withdrawing from the Middle East, and is an advocate of minimizing the U.S. military footprint. In some ways, I think it's fair to say that at a broad level of preference, all of us are advocates of minimizing the footprint to the extent possible, but much of today's debate or conversation, and it will have a little of a flavor of both, is just how do you do that and how much disengagement is reasonable and desirable, or to what extent is staying around in some places with some degree of presence, at least the sort of least bad option for American national security policy. And getting into that kind of topic with a real expertise on South Asia is my friend and colleague, Medea Afzal, who is an expert on both Afghanistan and Pakistan, wrote an excellent book a couple of years ago called Pakistan Under Siege, one of the best modern studies on Pakistan. I would recommend it to anyone and have asked many of my students in recent years to read it. She is a David Rubenstein Fellow at Brookings and continues her work on the broader South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan theater, as well as on Nigeria, because she's also interested in education and the way that influences people's attitudes towards the state and towards extremism. And then finally, my good friend and colleague, Vonda Felbert-Brown, who has done some of the most extraordinary research I have ever witnessed or read about throughout much of the world, including certainly in the Central Command theater, the broader Middle East. Two of the places where she's done her most impressive field research have been Somalia and Afghanistan, where she is famous for not just hunkering down in the relatively safe green zones of those places, which is where you'll usually find me if I'm over in a place like Afghanistan, but out in the field, talking to people, seeing what's happening on the ground with remarkable bravery and a lot of preparatory work to make sure that she can get out into the field in places where she will be able to learn so much from her work. She is an ongoing and very active expert in all matters Afghanistan, Pakistan at Brookings, but continues to research as well criminality, drug trafficking, pandemic disease origins, wildlife, and wildlife markets in places like Indonesia, China, Brazil, Mexico, and elsewhere. So we're delighted to have you join us as well in the audience, and we will look forward to your thoughts in the latter part of this discussion. We'll go until about 2:15. Vonda will have to leave us just a few minutes before 2, but we're going to start this by my posing a broad question to Chris about what have we gotten right and what have we gotten wrong in these last 20 years or so in the Middle East. And then I'll have a similarly broad framing question for each panelist thereafter. We'll have a second round here with us and then go to you and your thoughts and questions. So again, very pleased to have you here with us today. And Chris, without further ado, the floor is yours, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. And thanks to Brookings and the Charles Koch Institute for sponsoring this event. I think that my remarks will be mostly to try to set the context. I think it is helpful every once in a while to ask how it is that we got here. How is it that we're referring to a forever war? Was it truly a forever war, or did it start somewhere? Well, I think candidly, it did start after 9/11. We all know why. I think that if you had said to someone on September 10th, 2001, that 19 years hence, the United States would have spent $5.5 trillion already spent, would have lost the lives of over 7,000 American servicemen and women, 52,000 wounded, perhaps an equal number of 7,000 or more contractors killed. The cost of war project has good data on this. And perhaps 300,000 civilians killed in the various wars initiated after 9/11. They would be surprised, I think, to learn this. They would say, well, how did this all happen? And of course, again, then we go back to, well, the reason why it all happened is because of the horrific trauma of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, and the way that the United States and other countries around the world reacted after that horrific event. And I think that from time to time, you know, policy inertia is what it is, and policies don't change unless someone changes them. And so I think part of the reason why we have stayed in this path is because the political incentive to make a dramatic change has not been sufficient to do so. And occasionally people come along and suggest, as I recall that John Kerry in 2004 said that he thought that terrorism should be reduced to a nuisance, a sort of law enforcement problem. He was viciously attacked for that, not taking the threat seriously enough. Even people like John McCain or Mike Bloomberg at various stages said that the terrorism problem had been exaggerated. And sometimes they got away with it and sometimes they didn't. So I just think it's helpful every once in a while to ask, is this money spent, lives lost? Is it actually necessary to keep the United States safe? Is it actually necessary to reduce the risk of future acts of terrorism? And so far, I haven't seen any better assessment of this than by my former colleague, John Mueller, who's a Cato Senior Fellow, also, of course, a longtime professor at Ohio State University, and his co-author, Mark Stewart, who back in 2014 estimated that for the cost of what we have spent on counterterrorism since 9/11, we would have to believe that those counterterrorism measures were responsible for stopping roughly 1,667 Times Square type attacks. That is the attack that was attempted back in 2010. So in other words, four such attacks every single day. And if we don't believe that the various measures that have been taken under the broad rubric of the war on terror and the forever war are actually essential or useful in stopping those sorts of terrorist attacks, then I think we really should wonder whether that $5.5 trillion might have been spent better elsewhere. And even more importantly, we might have wondered whether some of the hundreds of thousands of lives lost along the way these people would still be alive today.
Chris, thank you very much for the excellent framing and focus on the big questions. And now I'd like to turn to Medea and to ask, I know Medea, you're no fan of unnecessary deployments to the broader South Asia or Afghanistan theaters, but I've also read enough of your work to know that you're not of the view that pulling out now would be the smartest decision either. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your thinking on both Afghanistan and Pakistan and how we should think about them in the context of the so-called forever wars and the incoming Biden administration. Over to you, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, exactly. I think I'm no fan of staying in a forever war, but I think the discussion on policy options for Afghanistan in Washington is increasingly framed as a binary choice. Either that we should leave Afghanistan now, and that if we choose to stay, that we'll end up staying forever. And I think that's an unhelpful framing. So as I've argued before, I think there is a middle of the road option that will serve us best. And that is that the US should commit to maintaining a small troop presence, several thousand troops in Afghanistan, until an intra-Afghan peace deal between the Taliban and Kabul is achieved. And this would likely take a few years, 3 to 5 years. Of course, you know, that's being hopeful, but that's the hope. During sort of a very slow, painstaking process of negotiations between these two parties. So I'm not arguing that the Doha deal that was struck in February should be abandoned. I'm actually arguing for working within the gray areas of the deal, such as they are, and the fact that the conditions that were put in place under the Doha deal have not been met to date. So what does staying until an intra-Afghan peace deal is achieved do? So my argument is that it benefits both Kabul and the United States. It gives Kabul leverage to negotiate the best possible deal it can with the Taliban and crucially try to preserve gains in human rights and women's rights. And a good outcome for Afghanistan will serve us well in America, both in terms of our core objective of counterterrorism, but also in terms of narratives on America and the region. Because we should be clear that any poor outcomes in Afghanistan down the road will be seen as America's failure and the failure of this forever war. I'd also argue that framing the war in Afghanistan as endless war, as I said, is unhelpful because the war has basically wound down for America. By January 20th, we'll be at less than 2-3% of the height of our troop presence there. And so all that this terminology serves is to make this a politically charged question, an unnecessarily politically charged question. I'd also argue that the urge to leave now and that saying that nothing good can come of staying misses this sort of key window of opportunity that we have with the start of the inter-Afghan peace negotiations, you know, these historic peace negotiations. It assumes that if we leave now, if we don't leave now, that we'll get pulled into things again in Afghanistan to a greater degree. And I don't think that assumption is necessarily accurate. And on the contrary, if we do leave now, the cost is high. I mean, we should be clear that the future looks grim if we leave completely now, you know, and it ranges from violence to civil war to regional proxy wars to an ultimate Taliban ascendance, you know, again, not to sound too grim, but that's what it looks like. Just two more points very quickly. I think with President Trump's decision to wind down troops to 2,500 troops, which, you know, in the last few days, which there was no need to do per the Doha deal right now, and conditions for doing this have not been met, we should be clear. I think he's done real damage. He's weakened not only the American position, but that of our allies, and also Kabul's position. And the only party that this benefits is the Taliban. So when Biden comes into power in January, he'll have very little room for maneuver. And I think his hands will be tied. And the ability to have leverage over the Taliban, the ability to pressure the Taliban as we need to do, becomes that much harder. But perhaps there's still a possibility that this can be done with 2,500 troops. My sense is that he won't want to increase troops right away, especially not in terms of the first decision he takes, because that will be unpopular. But I do think that if President Biden in 2021 thinks that a few thousand troops more are what we need to ensure a better outcome, that he should take that decision, that if we need to go up to 4,500 again, that he should take that decision, and he may eventually. Just a word on Pakistan. I think the question of Afghanistan has been central to our relationship with Pakistan. And of course, Pakistan's actions have affected how the war in Afghanistan has gone and it goes. And I think the last 2 years, things have been all right with Pakistan. Pakistan has been helpful in the Afghan peace process and the relationship between the two countries has improved. So I'd argue that the best chance for us to have a fruitful future relationship with Pakistan is if the Afghan peace process comes to a full conclusion. Because with a peaceful Afghanistan, that benefits Pakistan, and then we can focus on other things in that relationship. Whereas with an Afghanistan that descends into violence due to a hasty withdrawal, that country will become a theater for regional proxy wars, and a number of other countries will get drawn in, but Pakistan might as well. And that is not a desirable outcome for anyone.
Medea, thank you very much. Justin, I'd like to go to you next. And again, I'd welcome any thoughts you've got at this stage of the conversation in regard to the topic before us, but also would welcome hearing a little bit about the argument in your paper that you published that I referred to in the introduction. So the floor is yours, my friend.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks to you for moderating. Thanks to all the other panelists for participating. And an early happy Thanksgiving, as happy as it can be for everybody who's watching. So Chris has sort of argued that something has gone really wrong with the forever wars, right? We don't know how much longer they're going to go on. They've quite clearly failed to achieve the aims that we've sort of gradually expanded over time. I think you can tell a different story where, you know, in 2002, you say we've actually dealt a pretty decent blow to Al-Qaeda and sent a good message to the Taliban in Afghanistan. But I want to expand on what Chris has said, because as you mentioned, I wrote this paper, and I want to argue that these wars should end. And so it's not just that they've failed to achieve their aims, but rather that we've failed to situate the greater Middle East in a broader strategic context, right? We fancy ourselves a global power with global interests everywhere. And so I think what animated the paper and what will animate my brief remarks here is an interest in trying to situate the greater Middle East in a broader strategic context. What I looked at was sort of traditional measures of power, right? So if you look at the greater Middle East, it contains about 3.3% of world GDP. That's on its way down because of sinking oil prices, I think probably closer to 3% of world GDP. Depending on how you count, it contains about between 3.5% and 5% of world population. And no country within the region can project power outside its borders in a meaningful way, right? Iran can't conquer Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia can't conquer Iran. The idea of a regional oil hegemon or something like this is just fanciful. So sometimes we have these discussions, what should we do in Syria? How can we push the Iranians and the Russians back in Syria? And this paper sort of says, what do we actually need from Syria in a broader strategic context? Now, in looking at that, I drew on the work of Eugene Goltz at Notre Dame and on our esteemed moderator, Michael O'Hanlon, who've tried to get a handle on what we spend on the Persian Gulf mission, the sort of broader Middle East mission. And this is an inexact science, as probably everyone knows, but it's on the order of about $70 billion a year in peacetime, in addition to the $5.5 trillion that Chris mentioned, if you count Iraq, Afghanistan, and the sort of post 9/11 wars. So it's real money, right? And that's basically the sort of the argument that to say $70 billion a year for this. And so I looked at what we worry about in the greater Middle East. What are the concerns that we think this resource expenditure warrants? What are they after? And I basically concluded that oil, Israel, and terrorism are the main sort of concerns, with nuclear nonproliferation as a sort of third and a half reason that we can talk about. But I looked at what we worry about when it comes to oil markets, what we worry about when it comes to Israel, and what we worry about when it comes to terrorism, and conclude that having, you know, 50, 60, 70,000 troops in this part of the world is not necessary to protect what are actually limited threats to those interests. And I'm happy to go into those discussions in the Q&A, because this is an extremely bite-sized version of the argument. But I think the central problem here is that the United States has had so few internal or external constraints on its foreign policy that it's been able to spend a lot of money, almost unlimited money at times, on both guns and butter. And the essence of strategy is about choice. And when countries are failed, don't have any need to choose, frequently their strategies can become extravagant. And I think that's part of the problem here.
Justin, thank you. One quick clarifying question before I go to Vonda, just to make sure that I understand the scope of your analysis, since the term Middle East gets used in many different ways. When you talk about 3 to 3.5% of world population, what's your definition of the Middle East that you're applying?
From the Eastern Med to Afghanistan.
So including Afghanistan, but not including Pakistan and not including Turkey.
Correct. I'll have to go back and look at Turkey, but it wasn't an immense swing one way or the other, tenths of a percentage point.
Thank you very much for those opening thoughts. And now, Vonda, over to you. And you're intriguing on this issue like everyone, because, again, you've been such a stalwart student of the Afghanistan conflict. But I believe it's fair to say, and you'll explain here in a second, that you've now decided that the peace process requires a whole different look at the U.S. military posture and a different approach. And of course, I very much eagerly anticipate your thoughts on Somalia as well. So my friend, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. Let me start by making a little bit broader comments and emphasizing something that Justin said and endorsing it. that when we think about U.S. military engagements in situations such as Afghanistan, Somalia, or Iraq, we have to think not solely in terms of the developments and in U.S. interests and developments on the ground there, but also the opportunity cost. This is rarely done in foreign policy and U.S. strategy, where once a engagement is launched, often the predominant lens applied looks at how to make the mission succeed, whether it is a military mission or other forms of missions. The second trap that we often fall into is thinking that a set of U.S. interests, including very real counterterrorism interests, imply and necessitate boots on the ground. And this is part U.S. Military deployment. And this is particularly true about other U.S. interests, such as interests in human rights, women's rights, U.S. Economic objectives, as well as geopolitical competition. Those are all very, very important interests. And I would not want to see U.S. policy lose those interests and, frankly, those values. This is who we are as Americans. But the fact that those are important and interests and objectives does not mean that they should always, under all circumstances, be addressed through military deployments, particularly lengthy deployments. The third broad point I would make is that there is a real risk of policy not rarely falling into the trap of sunk costs, the tyranny of sunk costs, where we look at engagement and say we have devoted this tremendous amount of effort, sacrifice, blood and treasure, and really do not focus on the much more psychologically uncomfortable, much more emotionally uncomfortable marginal utility and marginal cost. So when we spend $40 billion a year on maintaining our military deployment in Afghanistan, we have to ask, where else could we put that money? That amount of money could prevent deforestation and biodiversity degradation per year around the world. That has significant impact on preventing pandemics. It has the most crucial impact on preventing pandemics. And we see the devastation in terms of lives and the devastations in terms of economy, human development opportunities that COVID has spent. So this is just one example that I am picking in comparison. Yet rarely we look at the opportunity costs. And we also then need to couple the analysis of opportunity costs, marginal utility and marginal costs with prospects for success and how those change over time. And this is, in my view, the frame that we should be applying to decisions on how we engage, rather than a preset notion that a grand strategy always looks in a certain way, or that promotion of certain rights, objectives, interests implies certain military deployment. Now, let me come to some of the specifics that you asked very quickly in Afghanistan. First of all, I want to emphasize in both Afghanistan and Somalia that even if one makes the judgment that withdrawal of U.S. forces is right, that doesn't mean that withdrawal under all circumstances at all moments is equally right. For example, Somalia is on the cusp of parliamentary and presidential elections in December and February that can easily end up very violent, pulling in the entire region. The tensions between Mogadishu and member state governments is at an all-time high. Withdrawing U.S. troops right now, as opposed to waiting several months to get through the elections, simply greatly amplifies an already enormously combustible situation. There is no need to do it, and I do not support that policy. It should be separate from asking what is the marginal effect, the marginal utility of keeping those deployments there. Let me wind up by a few comments on Afghanistan. I agree with Madiha's analysis that the departure of U.S. troops prior to a Afghan-Taliban deal and with the deal between the Afghan Republic and the Taliban will significantly worsen the terms of the deal and may precipitate intensification of civil war. However, Afghanistan is already civil war. U.S. troops might not be dying in great numbers, but 40,000 Afghans are dying on a yearly basis. And that rate is only intensifying. The Taliban is already ascendant. U.S. Engagement in Afghanistan has failed to reverse that, and there is no prospect for reversing it, even if the United States and the Biden administration again increases its military presence. It will simply slow down the rate with which the Taliban is ascendant on the battlefield, but will fundamentally not change that. I was a supporter of the surge and believe that we should have negotiated then. Every day negotiations are delayed, the terms of the deal are worse. In fact, the Obama administration tried to negotiate, but the Taliban refused. One, because the Obama administration wanted to have the Afghan government be in lead. The issues that are criticized today have a long history. My last word is that I fundamentally don't believe that if U.S. Troops stay in Afghanistan beyond the May deadline, the Taliban will simply accept it. I think there is a room and opportunity to negotiate a short delay, perhaps until the end of 2021, with the Taliban. Beyond that, however, regardless of the legality, the Taliban will simply feel betrayed, even by a counterterrorism mission. Now, we might say we don't care about the betrayal of the Taliban, that the Taliban feels betrayed, but it will start attacking U.S. bases, even only counterterrorism bases, which will neuter their counterterrorism options or will result in us being pulled into back into an open-ended war with the Taliban. And this is my last comment here. We are using the term forever wars, but for many, it is a pejorative term. I would rather use the term open-ended war. Over to you, Mike.
Thanks, Vonda. So now let's go into a second round. And what I'd like to do is invite each panelist to just respond based on what they've heard from each other. So that's certainly part of this next phase of discussion. I'd like to tweak the order slightly because, Chris, I want to begin with you again, but then go to Justin and then ask Medea and Vonda both about Afghanistan with a specific question about the peace process. So I think it makes sense to ask them together, although certainly everyone can comment on the whole region. But Chris, let me begin. You began at a very clear and conceptual grand strategic level in your analysis. I'd like to push you a little further to ask you where you would like to see the U.S. military presence in the broader Middle East reduced or any other form of U.S. Application of national power. And as you well know, because you're such a good military scholar and you have Navy experience, we have a big Navy presence in Bahrain. We have a big Air Force base in Qatar. We have big Army logistics capability and some Air Force capability in Kuwait. We have the smaller combat-related operations in Iraq and Syria, a little bigger in Iraq, but those are primarily focused on the specific problems inside of those countries or pieces of those countries. Then we have some forces again in Saudi Arabia, which was not true for most of the Obama period, but has been true again as the Houthi rebels and the Iranians have leveled threats against Saudi oil facilities and the Saudi capital airfield. And then we have smatterings of capability going as far south in this broader region, of course, as Djibouti, which may technically be in the AFRICOM military theater for the United States, but is still, of course, relevant to the Central Command and Middle Eastern theaters. So with all of that in mind, as well as Afghanistan, could you give us a couple of examples of where you would like to cut, but also maybe where you think we should stay? Over to you.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. I think that we need to differentiate between a sort of steady state, permanent U.S. overseas presence and that additional increment of presence that is connected to the post 9/11 wars. The United States has had forces in some number for various missions going back to the Carter Doctrine, right, since the late 1970s. In the Persian Gulf and in Red Sea and around the Horn of Africa, et cetera. And so as a person who believes in a naval presence, one of the great advantages, of course, in naval vessels is that they move. Luckily, if you're fortunate, if you're the main propulsion assistant on a ship like I was years ago, and if the screws are turning and the lights are on, then you're doing your job. That's good, right? They move. That's the whole point. The difference, however, I think in a lot of the presence that we've established since 9/11 is that the physical presence of U.S. forces in many of these places can become a lightning rod for resistance and radicalism, and even in the most extreme cases, violence. I'm reminded no less a figure than Paul Wolfowitz made the case for the war in Iraq in 2003 on the argument that we were not going to leave forces, to your question, Mike, about U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. We were not going to leave forces in Saudi Arabia after the attack on Saddam Hussein in 2003 because precisely they were a lightning rod for terrorist attacks against the United States. So even advocates for the war in Iraq saw the benefit of being able to eventually reduce the permanent on-the-ground U.S. presence in places like this. And I think that also applies to the case of Afghanistan. I really want to associate myself with Vanda's comments. Even before she started speaking, I had scribbled down some notes about the trends in Afghanistan and why, if they are moving in an unpleasant direction from our perspective, why is that? And I think it's simply impossible to deny that the presence of U.S. forces, even small numbers of U.S. forces, has been an enormous lightning rod for the Taliban, who have managed to expand their control over this country over a period of many years. And one last point. A lot of times we hear that these forces in places like Iraq around the time of the surge or Afghanistan gives us leverage over our the opponents, whether it's the Taliban or whether it's resistance fighters inside of Iraq, or leverage over the governments that we're trying to get to behave the way we wish them to. And I think there's just not a lot of empirical evidence to support that claim. I think as often as not, you have governments that are empowered or encouraged to behave in reckless ways because they're confident that the United States will have their back no matter what. The classic moral hazard problem, or as Barry Posen likes to call it, reckless driving. This all comes back to, I don't want to miss an opportunity. Vonda's point is these are open-ended wars. Well, no people know this more acutely than the Afghan people, who have been fighting this civil war since what, for 42, 43 years? So what we really should be talking about, back to your question, Mike, is not where U.S. military presence should be or where it shouldn't be, but whether or not the U.S. military presence in all of these places is actually contributing to peace, is actually contributing to greater security for ourselves and for the people in the region, is actually making space for other forms of American engagement, trade, diplomacy, cultural exchange, or is it at the expense of those things? And I think many times we reach for the military hammer and we don't consider the other instruments of our power and influence. And that's where I think I would turn the question back on you, Mike. I'd say precisely because we approach these things in military terms, we don't take account of the unintended consequences, and we don't take account of the opportunity costs, as Vanda said. What could we be doing instead?
Thank you, Chris. And Justin, I'm going to go to you next for any comments you want to make at this point in the conversation, but also with the same question in mind, and maybe you're going to give me a variant of this, of a similar answer to what Chris just said and you had said initially, and I guess the title of your paper speaks for itself, that your view is fairly comprehensive. But I wonder if I could just push a little further and ask, are there some U.S. military positions, maybe some of the more remote locations, let's say in Qatar at Al Udeid Air Base, where you see a value in at least having some residual presence, or do you feel that your recommendation is fairly categorical and sweeping, and we'd just be better off not thinking of this as a theater where we need the capacity to get involved militarily at all? Over.
Yeah, so it's a good question, and maybe it's from having been proximate to Chris for so many years, but I am a Navy enthusiast relative to ground forces. So access agreements make a lot of sense to me. You could conceive of a time in the future where a regional hegemon might emerge in the Middle East. I think it's very unlikely, but an access agreement in a port is something that's actually pretty cheap. As to air bases and things like that, I mean, I think these countries need to demonstrate at a minimal level that they warrant defense on the part of the United States should something terrible happen. Many of them are still, even in these days, awash with money. So I'm not super sympathetic to the idea that, you know, we need to be pouring concrete over there constantly. So I did this, as you pointed out, very sweeping article and sweeping opening remarks. But I just want to sort of push, if I can, a couple of the hot button forever wars or open-ended wars or whatever term we choose to call them. Right? Like, can we conceive of a time when the last U.S. troop leaves Syria or when the last U.S. troop leaves Afghanistan or when the seemingly unslakable Saudi thirst to blast away at Yemen has been sated? And I don't, you know, Jim Jeffries said famously, we were looking for the enduring defeat of ISIS in Syria. I don't think those guys are going to sign a treaty on the decks of the Missouri somewhere. I mean, I think that these things almost seem set up to go on forever. And one of the questions that I had as I heard the discussion about Afghanistan was whether we needed to sort of renegotiate a new deal, whether the Taliban non-compliance with terms of the deal that was mentioned causes a sort of recapitulation of what we're trying to do over there. But I would just, it seems to me that we have many of these discussions about progress or decline in the absence of a theory of victory, of a sort of end state that we're looking for. And I think it's useful to try as best you can to flesh out, you know, what the end goal is and how what we're doing at present promises to get us there.
Thank you. And so now I'm going to come back to the South Asia theater for questions, actually the same question for both Mattia and Vonda. But of course, you can feel free to comment on a broader range of topics as well. As I do this, I'm going to be already weaving in a couple of the questions we've received from the audience, because there are questions about the kind of an Afghanistan peace deal we might realistically expect and how you would link the prospects to your preferred approach, with Mattia preferring to stay perhaps a number of months or even years. And I'm curious about the time frame, Mattia, that you would anticipate for the peace process. For Vonda, perhaps with the U.S. and NATO forces already having left over the next few months by somewhere in the late spring of 2021, what prospects you would see on issues like Afghanistan's women's rights, the prospects for meaningful power sharing between the Taliban and some kind of elected government, what would happen to security forces? Would they be merged? Would the Taliban essentially replace the Afghan army and police with its own fighters? How would that work? There are a number of questions about sort of what kind of Afghanistan we're likely to get to based on your own prescription for the peace process. And so that's a pretty big question, but at least it has the virtue of beginning with the specific question of how long do you think the peace process might take under your recommended framework? So that maybe as a starting point for both of you, and then please branch out into what kind of an Afghanistan do you think might follow after a deal? Starting with Mattia, please.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. So I think, you know, maybe if I can respond very quickly to a point Justin made, you know, what is the end state that we visualize? What is the end state of victory? The end state of victory is a peace deal that has been achieved, an intra-Afghan peace deal that has been achieved, and the last American troop leaves Afghanistan at that point. To me, that is an end state that the whole region wants, frankly. I mean, Pakistan's government says it wants this. Afghanistan's government says it wants this. Of course, the Taliban is the one insisting that the U.S. leave by May 2021, regardless of whether or not an intra-Afghan peace deal is achieved. But in terms of what form I think this might take and how long this might take, I think the Kabul government has been stalling the process a little bit, and perhaps in the hope of a Biden victory, it was doing so. But I do think that the U.S. Has pushed as much as possible. I think Zalmay Khalilzad's many trips to the region have tried to push this process along. But even now, we're at a point where we're still they're still reaching agreement on sort of the terms of the discussion. So this is a long process because the Taliban in Kabul are fundamentally opposed in what their vision of Afghanistan is. So this is not going to be easy. But and there is a real possibility that this would fail, right? Because they don't at this point agree on much at all. So it's not that I'm saying that there is a certain outcome that an intra-Afghan peace deal might be achieved, but I, you know, for the possibility of an intra-Afghan peace deal, that is what we should work towards. So I would say that with the US's help, with Pakistan's help, and Pakistan certainly has been helping with this process, even with the intra-Afghan process, you know, Khalilzad's been in Islamabad visiting. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan just made a trip to Kabul for the first time ever for him. And he has basically said that he will do whatever he can to help reduce violence and to help with the peace process. So we should not, I mean, we should take that help, even if with a grain of salt. And so with all this help, I think, an optimistic prediction might be a few years, 3 to 5 years, as I've argued. And then what form might it take? Some kind of power sharing agreement, you know, the form that I think urban Afghans, you know, young Afghans would want it to take would be an Afghanistan which is democratic and which preserves at least the basic gains in women's rights. Girls can go to school, women can go to work, and that people don't get their heads chopped off in a stadium like they did in the 1990s. You know, that's what we would want in terms of sort of the very basics of the outcomes. And I think, whether or not it's a democracy, what form the constitution might take, you know, we will have to sort of see whether it becomes a little bit more like Iran. We will have to see. But an outcome that is that both sides accept will be the outcome that I think we will have to accept. Just two quick other responses. One, in terms of sort of, I think there is a tendency to think of this in the 20-year time frame. I don't think we should think of the decision in the 20-year time frame and think about all the cost of it, as well as what is the benefit that we've sort of achieved. I think we should at this point think of the decision in front of us, so the cost versus the benefit of the sort of the fork in the road in front of us at this point. But I do think Afghanistan needs to be thought of in relative isolation in terms of sort of the theater of the world's conflicts, right? So should we be spending money on the US domestically? Should we be spending money on climate change, or should we be spending money on Afghanistan? I'm not sure that is the frame to think of, but I think the frame to think of is Afghanistan in isolation and the cost and the benefit there. And when you look at it that way, it becomes very clear. I think The Economist said it very well in its sort of leader, in its past issue, you know, the cost of leaving is high. The cost of staying is low, not indefinitely, for a few years, just because of sort of what Afghanistan might descend into in terms of the cost of leaving right away. I think two other very, very, very quick points on counterterrorism and the unintended consequences of us staying. So counterterrorism, I don't think we should discount the threat of ISIS, Khorasan, of Al-Qaeda, of all these other terrorist groups in the region, and what a Taliban victory, even though ISIS, Khorasan is in opposition to the Taliban, but what a Taliban victory, that legitimacy, what kind of boon that is to terrorist groups in the region. It serves their propaganda. And the more we can walk away with an achievement of something that is different from what they want, that is a narrative victory for the United States. And finally, in terms of sort of how these groups benefit from us staying and sort of that being the unintended consequence. Yes, it benefits their propaganda, but we should be clear that these groups derive their recruits from other sort of other roots, other local grievances, local narratives. And it's not that they derive all of their recruitment, et cetera, from the fact that the US is in the region. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. And Vonda, over to you for that same broad framing about what do you expect from a peace process on a number of the other dimensions that I referred to and anything else you'd like to bring in at this point. Over to you.
Well, Mike, when the Doha deal was signed on February 29th, I published a Brookings piece in which I essentially argued that this was a very bad deal. But at the same time, it was the best deal that was obtainable. And Ambassador Khalilzad very much tried pushing for a different deal, one that would, where the withdrawal of U.S. troops would only commence after a inter-Afghan peace deal was accomplished, and couldn't get it from the Taliban. There's no surprise that's been the Taliban unwavering position since 2007, 2008, 2009, when original feelers for negotiations started. Meanwhile, compared to those years, the Taliban is significantly more powerful on the battlefield than it had been, and the U.S. capacity to shape the Taliban and its military actions is much reduced. So every day, the deal that's obtainable becomes a worse deal. At the same time, it's a deal that the Afghan government hates, namely the Doha deal. It very much does not want the deal, it wishes for the deal to collapse. Why? Because at minimum, the deal obligates it to share power with the Taliban, but more likely it means that the Taliban will be the dominant actor in the deal. Now, the Afghan government, and I think many in U.S. Policy and polity would wish for a deal that's Colombia-like. In fact, the Afghan government frequently brings advisors from Colombia. What is the essence of the deal there? Well, the FARC essentially agreed to suspend its military conflict in exchange for broad leniency and amnesty, very minimal terms for anyone who discloses to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission's crimes. There are really very small penalties. And the Taliban is the FARC is guaranteed a token representation in the Colombian Congress and needs to compete in elections. So essentially, it's a deal of not going to jail, not having to fight anymore, and having minimal political impact. And it has done badly in elections now. However, the deal is completely unrealistic given the battlefield picture in Afghanistan. In Colombia, the conflict was stalled. Because the conflict was stalled, the Colombian government agreed to negotiate, as did the FARC leadership. But it was still at the low level of conflict with the FARC's steady weakening. In Afghanistan, it's no longer true that the conflict is stalled. The Taliban is slowly ascendant. So the Taliban doesn't want a deal that's Colombia-like, minimal token of political representations, few ministries, perhaps a province here and there, or a local representation in the government in provinces. It wants to be the dominant actor. And it has the military have to be asking those domains, with the Afghan security forces continually dramatically dependent on the United States. When U.S. withdraws, the political dynamics and security dynamics will worsen severely. The Taliban will have the capacity to take over and hold provincial capitals. The factionalization and defections in Afghan security forces will only dramatically amplify, as will separate deals between the Taliban and power brokers. And many of the important Afghan politicians today are hardly defenders in democracy, human rights, and women's rights. So I think that an optimistic scenario would be an Iran-like system where the Taliban, or rather a likely scenario is the way to phrase it, where the Taliban would agree to some elections taking place at sub total authority level, while there is a religious authority composed of the Taliban that rules over that. That's a dire prospect. I would say even it's an odious prospect. The Taliban is not nice, moderated actor. Do we have any capacity? But it's the real prospect. And the prospect of a Colombia-like deal is simply fantasy that is not achievable unless the policy becomes just staying and hoping and praying that something will break. That has been the essence of US policy since about 2014, hanging on and hoping that the Taliban will make enough mistakes and will weaken itself. That hasn't happened, and I think there is little likelihood that will emerge, that such a development will emerge now. But we have tools to shape the Taliban through means other than military presence on the ground. The Taliban clearly wants to have a working relationship with the United States when it is in government, and it is very sensitive and constantly speaks about the desire to maintain U.S. and international aid. Those are tools that need to be deployed to shape the Taliban's behavior, to emphasize the need for at least some inclusivity of ethnic minorities, some protection for women's rights. I want to make two broad comments in concluding. One links to the issue of terrorism, as terrorism really has been the dominant interest the United States has had in engaging in Afghanistan. And, you know, one can almost always make the argument that having troops on the ground, whether it's Somalia or Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Niger or other place in the world, gives the U.S. more strike capacity, whether air or on the ground, than not having that present. That is absolutely true. But that question, again, needs to be weighed against the costs. And I would say that in this case, the cost is the really threatening emergence of right-wing domestic violence in the United States, with many of the self-styled groups that often call themselves militias are a direct product of U.S. open-ended military engagement. So by combating terrorism abroad in open-ended war, we are also creating a fire hose of feeder for domestic terrorism and a critical undermining of rule of law. That cost needs to be weighed in, and one needs to judge what threat of terrorism is more imminent, how one can address one and at the same time mitigate the other and not exacerbate it. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. So here's how I'd like to handle the last 20 minutes or so. Vonda, I have one specific question for you, which I think we can get in before you have to leave. And then I'm going to take the audience questions, of which there are about four or five broad themes, and put them all before the remaining three of you all together at once, and then give you each about 5 minutes to respond to those one or two questions that you find of greatest interest or relevance to your specialization or your research. So Vonda, before you have to peel off, we haven't talked a lot about Iraq. And of course, Iraq has been one of the longstanding American preoccupations in this region going back to 1990. Do you basically favor keeping the 3,000 or 2,500 U.S. forces who are apparently going to be in Iraq when President Biden is inaugurated for some additional length of time in order to continue training, intelligence gathering, air power support? Or do you want to see that number phase down fairly quickly as well? Over to you.
I don't think that we are seeing the same pressures and marginal impact and cost in Iraq as we are in Afghanistan. The setting is different, and so I think there is a good reason to not come into the administration with an a priori policy that those forces should be withdrawn. Nonetheless, I think that that policy needs to be reconciled with how we handle Iran and how we handle pro-Iranian militias, where clearly our pro-Iranian, where our Iran policy is driving pro-Iranian militias into attacks on U.S. bases that paralyze its advisory capacity or undermine, is a more accurate term, that undermine its advisory capacity and undermine counterterrorism actions. So the Trump administration policy was in some ways the worst of all worlds, where we were maintaining troops, which come with all the costs, and at the same time disabling their capacity to engage objectively. And all of that requires a very careful reconsideration of how we handle the hashed, how we deal with an entity that has many factions, but that nonetheless is part state entity, obviously part of Afghan security forces. At the same time, it's partly a militia whose members are designated by the United States as terrorist actors. And so those are some of the issues that we are grappling with at the New Brookings Initiative, called the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors, that Mike, you and Maniha are members of and I direct, and that I expect will become what we need to grapple with in very many different parts of the world, how to deal with those hybrid actors, non-state armed actors that are hardly pleasant in many ways, but at the same time, closely linked to the government. With that, I want to thank everyone for the excellent conversation so far. Mike, for the invitation and your masterful moderation, and I apologize that I need to leave.
Thank you, Vanda, and we appreciate it very much, and we'll continue on here with the remaining questions, of which there are, as I said, about four or five. And so I hope that Chris, Justin, and Medea, you can each take notes, and maybe we'll go in that order and give you 5 minutes or so to respond to whichever specifics you'd like. One is going to be forecasting the Biden administration. And specifically, Bill Hartung asks a question about whether some of President-elect Biden's previous thoughts on this region, which tended to emphasize special forces and standoff air power even before that was in vogue, whether perhaps, therefore, there's a consistency with some of what the Biden team or the Biden, you know, president himself may favor, and whether that is along the lines of what you've been advocating, and whether that is also similar to what President Trump's already been doing. In other words, how much disruption do you really anticipate with the new team? And is it going to be adequate to make you happy based on what we can see in our crystal balls? So that's a broad question about where Biden's likely to go. A second question is about the role of India, especially in South Asia, and to what extent should we be asking India to do more? To what extent can India do more, let's say, in Afghanistan? To what extent can we push India and Pakistan to negotiate over Kashmir, if you want to extend your gaze that far eastward, even though it's a little beyond what's normally brought within the scope of the forever wars and the CENTCOM region, but to the extent you believe it might be relevant to the broader problem we're discussing today, feel free to have at it. Another question that takes us further east, but is potentially relevant, is to what extent do you favor the so-called rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region of the Obama administration going back almost a decade? And to what extent would your proposed policy of relative disengagement from the Middle East, especially for Chris and Justin, to what extent would that facilitate an ongoing effort to quote unquote rebalance or to prioritize, you know, the China threat and the broader Indo-Pacific theater and to do less in the Middle East? And then I'm getting near the end of my questions, but perhaps that's the right way to leave it, because we do have a few more specific questions on Afghanistan, which I'm going to apologize to those in the audience that since we've already had a fair amount of discussion on Afghanistan, unless the panelists want to go in that direction themselves already about what future role the UN may have, for example, and to what extent economic assistance could be used as leverage to get a Taliban-dominated government to behave better and protect some of the human rights and women's rights that Medea was talking about earlier. If you want to touch on that, feel free. But primarily, I'd like to ask for you to comment on the Biden administration, on the role of India, and then on the broader prioritization of the Asia-Pacific theater, perhaps the rebalance policy now being reinvigorated, if we can find a way to draw down from the Middle East, if that's something that you agree with and favor. So, Chris, that's a lot, but I know you can handle a good chunk of it very well. So over to you, my friend.
Well, thanks, Mike, for your confidence. I did take notes. I'm mostly going to leave the question about India to Medea because I'd really like to hear it from her. I will just make one comment on this. To the extent that Pakistan's behavior vis-a-vis Afghanistan is driven by security concerns, legitimate or otherwise, we can just sort of bracket that question, then certainly some sort of improvement in relations between India and Pakistan should help to ease their concerns with respect to Afghanistan. So I'll leave it at that. And again, I'm curious to hear from Nadia on that question. I'm mostly going to focus on the first question, Mike, because I think Justin has a lot to say about the rebalance, and I'll leave that mostly to him. But on the question of sort of forecasting Biden and where we are and where we're headed, I think this all comes back to what has, starting with the president-elect and all of the people who are coming in with him, what have they learned from our experience of the last 20 years? Do they believe that these wars have, for the most part, advanced American security, made us more prosperous, more resilient? Have they advanced the cause of peace elsewhere? Have they helped to spread American values? Do they believe that? Or do they believe that a different approach is warranted? My survey of this, when you look at it along a generational perspective, one of the great ironies of President-elect Biden being the oldest man to assume the office when he's sworn in, is there the real possibility for a generational shift that's taking place from the baby boomers and my small Gen X generation to the next generation, millennials, and ultimately Gen Z. Because I think you see in millennials much more interest in American engagement through diplomacy and trade and cultural exchange, and much less support for military operations. One last point, and that has to do with prioritization. And I think this gets to Bill Hartung's question too, is the main disruption that we have all experienced over the last 9 months, not quite, is the fact that we're all doing this by Zoom, right? By a disease that we had not prepared for, and the instruments of power that we have were not suited to deal with. And so the question is, are we in the future going to rebalance how we define threats? And might it be, and I certainly hope that it is, that the fear of terrorism recedes finally after a very, very long time, and fear of other things that are far more likely to do you harm or even kill you are elevated. And if that's true, then the instruments of power that we need to deal with those other threats will naturally rise to the surface. So the true question is, will we see downward pressure on the military budget? Will we see downward pressure on military spending? And will some of that increment of savings be redirected here at home to rebuild our power here at home, our infrastructure, our educational system, or will it be diverted elsewhere abroad? And I think that's a really open question right now.
Chris, thank you very, very much. Justin, over to you.
Yeah, so as I mentioned yesterday to you, as I started doing this, I thought, oh gosh, they're going to make me try to predict Biden's foreign policy. And you assured me that I didn't have to do that. But now I'll sort of, now that I did a little bit of the spade work, I'll do my best. I'm a personnel or policy guy. We have a few drip of appointments. We have a few more that we're waiting for with bated breath. And, you know, I would be interested to see deputy assistant secretaries, you know, on down to get a better arc of where I thought things were most likely to go. In this region, though, one thing that is definitely worth keeping an eye on is the emerging sort of Israel-Saudi axis that seems to be going both with the peace deals that have already been happened, not between Saudi, of course, but between UAE and Bahrain. But whether the sort of personal beefs we may recall between Joe Biden during one notable visit to Israel, and, you know, Biden has said flatly, we need to stop, you know, propping up the Saudi war in Yemen. So there are sort of, I don't want to say bombs waiting to go off, but there's some baggage there that's interesting and worth watching, right? If it comes to be the case that a sort of Israel-Saudi detente, let's at least call it, comes together, whether or not those two countries are really sort of clashing with a notional Biden, with the Biden administration. On the rebalance, I've done a lot of work on this. I mean, it's sort of interesting, right? Remember, it was supposed to be called the pivot to Asia. And if you talk to people who were in the Obama administration at the time, they had to stop calling it the pivot to Asia because our partners in the Middle East got the vapors. Because when I pivot away from you, I'm not looking at you anymore. I'm looking over here. So we had to call it the rebalance because that sort of sounded like it had more equanimity to it. So I really do impress on my China hawk friends, of which I'm not one, that, you know, the Middle East is eating your lunch. And if you look at a document like the NDS, for example, it was not the full-throated Justin Logan, the case for withdrawing from the Middle East, but it was really sanguine about the stated interests that were enunciated in the Middle East and implicitly what was needed to achieve those interests. So I do think if you can see, if you think there are going to be resource constraints for the United States going forward, the Indo-PAC people are really going to be looking at that bucket of money in CENTCOM. And I think that's a good thing, right? My former colleague Ben Friedman, Harvey Sapolsky at MIT are always on about inter-service competition, right? The best arguments that you can get for what's wrong with one mission or another come from guys inside that building who want that money for themselves, for their little mission. I think that sort of competition in terms of how we think about the world can produce fruitful information for us to analyze when we think about what's vital for our own security.
Thank you very much. And then finally to Medea.
Great. I'll touch on both the forecasting the Biden administration questions, a question as well as the India question. So very quickly, I think I mentioned some of this in my remarks, but I'm very curious to see what a Biden administration does in terms of whether or not Zalmay Khalilzad stays on for the Afghan peace process and who the Secretary of Defense will be. I think those two decisions will tell us a little bit more in terms of where the Biden administration may go. But I think it will take the Doha deal as is, and it will take the 2,500 troops as they are and aim to make a decision on a responsible withdrawal. You know, we've heard that term before, a responsible withdrawal from Afghanistan, but will be harder on the Taliban. You know, the Biden administration will, you know, if conditions are not met, you know, tell the Taliban that conditions are not being met, unlike the Trump administration. And I think there is obviously a real tendency or a real, you know, expectation that we have that it will benefit from the expertise of what, you know, the people in the Pentagon, for instance, are telling the decision makers. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that any decision that will be taken might be along, you know, some of the lines that I've been advocating for, at the very least, you know, keeping the 2,500 troops until there is much more clarity on the conditions of the Doha deal being met. So I'll stop there on that question. On the role of India and Pakistan and Afghanistan, so Pakistan's decisions forever in Afghanistan have been affected by the threat Pakistan has felt from India. So India has been the specter that has loomed over Pakistan's behavior vis-a-vis Afghanistan. So the threat of India on its eastern border meant that Pakistan wanted, you know, sort of this theory, there was this theory of strategic depth on its western border that, and that sort of defined the decisions that it took vis-a-vis Afghanistan. Pakistan now argues that it has moved on from the strategic depth logic and, you know, that's sort of the official line. But what we can see is that because India is not and has not been involved in the Afghan peace process, that has really allayed Pakistan's fears when it comes to Indian involvement in Afghanistan over the last couple of years. So India did not play a big role in the US Taliban peace process. It is not playing a big role in the intra-Afghan peace process. It really has not cultivated, you know, sort of a relationship with the Taliban to be able to sort of, you know, have any leverage over it. And so on. And so that fact has actually made Pakistan feel more confident and more secure and has allowed it to become a key partner of the Trump administration in helping along this process. And I think, you know, I think that's been a benefit on sort of a net assessment. So my argument would be, you know, right now, the two other quick things, India and Pakistan are not in a great place. This has to do with sort of everything that began with the Pulwama attack last February, but then with the revocation of Kashmir's autonomy. But increasingly in Pakistan now, there are fingers being pointed by the state towards India at acts of terrorism within Pakistan. Given that, you know, my worry is that if the peace process, the Afghan peace process, doesn't come to a full conclusion, Afghanistan, you know, recedes into some kind of situation of civil conflict, and then sort of a regional proxy war, combined with the fact that, you know, we have a Biden administration that is, you know, people are expect will be strengthening the U.S. relationship with India, sort of Pakistan's existential fears of Indian involvement on its western border in Afghanistan will come to the fore again. And that will imply a return to its theory of strategic depth. And that is to no one's benefit. Pakistan investing in proxies like the Taliban that it considers friendly to it at the expense of others that it might consider friendly to India. The best outcome for the region and for India and Pakistan would be if we see a stable Afghanistan. That means that Pakistan will also sort of focus more domestically, perhaps focus on, you know, sort of an economic and trade partnership with Afghanistan, economic trade partnership with the U.S., and it will and its existential fears will have less of a role to play in its decision making.
Well, listen, all three of you, Chris, Justin, and Medea, thank you very much. Thanks to our colleagues and teams at Catholic University and the Atlantic Council and Brookings and the Charles Koch Institute. And to everybody who's been with us today, we appreciate your participation and we wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving. Signing off.